Tonight's Shockwaves is brought to you by Shudder. AMC Network Shudder is a premium streaming video service super serving fans of all degrees with the best selection of horror and thrillers. Shudder's irrepressible and thriving community revels in all things provocative, evocative, and dangerous. From bantering with Shudder on social media and contributing fantastic irreverent reviews to relishing in member-only perks such as exclusive releases and VIP movie screenings, Shudder believes there is safety in numbers. Don't be left in the dark alone. You can now stream great thrillers, horror, and suspense for $4.99 a month or $49.99 a year. Shudder has the largest, fastest, growing, human-curated selection of thrilling and dangerous entertainment. To try Shudder for free for 30 days, go to shudder.com/podcast and use the promo code WAVES. That's Shudder, shudder.com/podcast and use the promo code WAVES.
You should go on Shudder right now just to watch Terrified. Use the code WAVES.
And I can confirm Terrified is Shockwaves approved.
Woo!
Because we did talk about this when I saw it at Fantasia.
Okay.
Tonight's episode is also sponsored by Fright Rags. Fright Rags is the number one source for horror t-shirts. With specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists, they offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. Recently released, Halloween may be over, but we've reprinted many of our popular Halloween releases, in stock and ready for the holidays. Also, keep Halloween haunts alive all year round with an official Haunters The Art of the Scare t-shirt. Brand new this week, our first Pet Cemetery collection, featuring four brand new shirts. More to come in 2019. And right now, you can get 10% off of any Fright Rags purchase with the code SHOCK10. Again, go to www.fright-rags.com, insert code SHOCK10, and get 10% off of any purchase. Good now through December 31st.
Today's episode of Shockwaves is sponsored by Diabolik DVD, featuring demented discs from all over the world. Check them out online at www.diabolikdvd.com. They are the number one source for horror, cult, and strange films from around the world. The company's movie buff owned and operated. If you're looking for rare, unique, and strange films, then you need to head on over to Diabolik DVD. They are constantly updating their inventory and have plenty of movies that you won't find anywhere else. They recently revamped their website, and ordering's never been easier. Right now on Diabolik, they have the all-exclusive Blu-ray of Death House, which has been called The Expendables of Horror, starring genre legends like Adrian Barbeau, Barbara Crampton, Bill Moseley, Debbie Rochon, Dee Wallace, Felicia Rose, Gunnar Hansen, Kane Hodder, Michael Berryman, Sid Haig, and Tony Todd, all in one movie, and it's a region-free Blu-ray. They also have the all-region Blu-ray of Cyborg, an alien fugitive crash lands on Earth and begins turning people into cyborgs that feed on animal flesh. Dylan and her best friend Eddie have to team up to stop the Cyborg before the whole town is assimilated into monstrous machines of destruction. Of course. So for all your horror and cult...
I have that problem every night.
Exactly. Of course you do. So for all your horror and cult cinema needs, head on over to www.diabolikdvd.com or find them on Facebook.
I just bought Candyman from them, the Arrow edition, and the Fog 4K.
And it's one of the only places you can find that extra disc in America, which is an all-region German. And I haven't done it yet, but I got to buy it.
Thankful for Diabolik DVD.
Christmas is coming. Diabolik DVD.
Yes.
Okay, and welcome to episode 122 of Shockwaves. Holy smokes, the whole gang is here.
I don't believe it.
Is this a dream? Is this all in my head?
I know.
Wait, yo, that's right. Turek's not real. He's part of
split
personality.
I am not really here.
Should I touch his face? If he's real, I'm not going to touch your face, dude.
Are any of you real?
So I was like, oh my God.
After Halloween, Ryan was able to afford a hologram version. He's at home and he gets to beam in every night.
Like when he Skyped from the set. Now he's a hologram.
It's like the Sith technology from Jedi.
Yes, but better sound quality.
Is more than 50% of the host dying this week, or are we okay finally?
I'm good.
I've still got a bit of
sniffles. You guys were sick?
I was sick from the shoes.
I sat over
there.
Yeah. I was like, no.
Yeah, both Elric and I sounded like shit last week. So,
and I just recorded an episode of the other show, and my nose was so blocked, I heard it, and I was like, oh my God, I sound so bizarre. I sound like I'm underwater.
So you should troll Elric about the other show and the way he sounds on it.
All I could think of was, listening to Becca's voice, and everybody who writes in it says, oh, I already love Becca's voice, but Becca's voice is extra raspy and
it's hot. Sexy. Somebody told me on Twitter it was sexy as fuck. And all I could think was,
I knew it.
I hurt so bad.
Worked for Kathleen
Thanks,
Turner.
Thanks, guys. No, and I had to do a talk back Q&A at a movie screening on Saturday night, and somebody else was like, your voice got so good since high school. Like, it's so smoky now. And I'm like, I'm really sick, man. Wow. So
you just got to stay sick, you know?
That's all what you the time. Do. I'm sick. Sorry. It's just, I can't do it. It hurts.
If this is your first time tuning in after 121 episodes,
we are sorry.
By the way,
we apologize.
I'm Rob Galuzzo. Yeah. That's Elric Kane to my left, Ryan Turek, and Rebecca McKendry.
Yay.
The whole game.
And then Mixmaster Mike, his name is Ernie.
Ernie doesn't get enough credit, but he's recording us.
Yeah. Sometimes smiles and nods and
sometimes
falls
asleep. Sometimes he nods, sometimes he falls asleep, sometimes he leaves the room for long.
But he is
sometimes
a professional.
He watches baseball on his phone. It's all
sometimes
good.
Sometimes he's watching baseball while we talk horror. It's all good.
It's all good.
Now he's leaving the room and
he's shrugging and saying, they're all right.
Cool.
He's wearing clothes. That's the main thing.
Yeah, that's
a good man
important.
For that. Thank you.
Yeah.
What the hell you been up to, man? Well, who wasn't here last time? You weren't here.
Ryan
was. So what the hell? What was going on? Tell us why.
What was going on last week?
Or what were you up to?
You were at dinner.
It was a work dinner. It was just like one of those priority work dinners. But nobody cares about that. They want to hear about what we're talking about.
The
horror. What
we've seen.
I do want to kick something off because this is fresh. This is literally fresh out of the screening. I saw Jonas Åkerlund's Lords of Chaos.
Oh, I keep hearing about this.
I am, as the kids say, shook. It is an excellent, excellent film.
That was in Beyond Fest, right?
It was at Beyond Fest. It was at Fantastic Fest. Rory Culkin.
Okay.
I'm blanking. Emery Cohen, I think his last name is. This is basically steeped in the world of Norwegian death metal, focusing on the band Mayhem.
Documentary?
It's inspired by the documentary.
Oh, gotcha.
I remember that documentary. Yeah. But as it begins, it says this is based on truth, lies, and the shit that happened.
Oh, cool.
And
so this is the documentary, but it's a fictionalized version of
correct.
It?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. It's a dramatization of what actually went down.
Because I love the documentary.
Yeah, the documentary is fantastic. And so you've got Rory Culkin as the member of the band Mayhem. It kind of follows the trajectory of their lead singer who killed himself, and then he took a photo of the suicide, which is fact and actually in the documentary. And then he meets a bassist, and it's kind of about this rivalry between the two of them. While one of them is running around Norway setting churches on fire, one of their other band members kills somebody. It's just like pure. It is, as the title evokes, pure chaos. And I got out of that screening and I felt like it was the Martin Scorsese version of a drama about the Norwegian death metal scene, because you can just imagine it's basically De Niro and Pesci going head to head in Casino. Yeah. It had that kind of structure. Even Rory Culkin's character has a voiceover in it.
Why is Åkerlund's name familiar? Because I do know the name. What did he make before that?
Oh, he's a major music video director. Yeah. He had his own band.
Okay. Spun.
Yeah.
Of course. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which has great energy.
So yeah. Yeah. And this is his most mature, most confident film yet. And it's incredibly, incredibly violent. Incredibly violent. I mean, there are some depictions of stabbings that I can't get out of my head right now.
So it's one of those. It's not horror, but it's got elements.
It's definitely on the fringe. Yeah.
And then I look him up, and he's done Beyonce videos, and Taylor Swift, Madonna. Yeah. A lot of Beyonce.
Venture did a lot of that.
Wow.
Yeah. So Lords of Chaos, it's coming out from Gunpowder and Sky, I believe, early next year.
Nice.
So check it out. And then, Becca's pulling up his other film. He's got a film called Polar with Mads Mikkelsen that's coming to Netflix, I believe. So.
Well, before you move on, why don't you give us your – now, did you see – you haven't
I did. I watched it. Okay. I went to see Suspiria.
All right. Let's
after.
Get you guys to now chiming in on Suspiria.
Yeah.
I mean, we'll chime in here and there.
Yeah. I didn't get through the entire – so what was – you guys both liked it or
– We did. We both agreed that it was kind of the polar opposite of the original, that everything that the original tried to do, this did the exact
just went in the opposite. I like it more as a witch movie than I do as a Suspiria world movie. Like and I will say this, having had more time to think about it, there's just too many ideas being trying to cram into this one movie,
and
that's probably my biggest issue with it.
Yeah. Yep.
It loses its focus, but there is a lot of stuff about it I really like, and I'm sure I'll watch it again and go, ooh, cool, you know?
Yeah.
What did you think?
Yeah, I'm somewhere in the middle where I'm leaning more towards like it. I mean, it's a 2.5 hour experience.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
It's incredibly dense.
Yeah.
I went and saw it with Natasha Crimani, who directed Imitation Girl, and she loved it. And so, like, as soon as we walked out, I just didn't have – I couldn't say how I felt about it. I was mm-hmm. like, I need to think about this a little bit because I don't know. But the more I thought about it after the fact – I mean, it's really weird that it is – called Suspiria?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, because I don't think of that other
movie.
They
could actually movie. Call it Mother, or like the Three Mothers. Or
Mother
something.
Stars,
like
Mother
yeah.
Things, you
know? Yeah, yeah.
In one movie.
But I mean, I like the music. I like the direction. I like, I was really kind of shocked that Tilda, I thought she was amazing in it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know until after that she played three
uh-huh.
of the characters.
What was the third?
Well, I can't give it away.
I'll tell you after. Yeah. But you shouldn't.
I can guess.
Yeah, she's at least three characters in the movie, and I didn't know that at all. I was fooled, even though I thought I'd heard about one of them.
Right.
And I was like, oh, but I was like, oh, that's a good actor they got for that role. I didn't realize that that was her. So that was very impressive. But also, like, I'm not sure if there was a point to that, you know, like, other than it's a cool gimmick that she's that amazing that she got to play all these characters.
She's really tight with the director too.
Yeah,
they've worked together in the past.
But it did for me because I knew one of them. It was everywhere on social media before it even came out. It just in my brain was like, oh, waiting for that twist, and that took away. So I'm looking forward to seeing it again without that in my brain.
Yeah, see, I didn't have that at all,
yeah,
and so
good.
I was like, oh, that was interesting, and. Yeah, and it was. I almost questioned if it was a horror movie per se until the last 20 or so minutes, which are like beyond horror movies.
But there's some
I don't know that, like the contortion dance scene.
Yeah, it's horrifying. But I didn't like it, again. It's like I still it skated the line of like, is it a horror movie or is it not? I don't know. But overall, the more I thought about it, I kind of like it and I would like to revisit it. Mm-hmm. It's a completely different type of experience than what the original Suspiria is. And I think it's always hard anytime you're remaking something or doing a sequel to it or whatever the case is, your first initial viewing, it's impossible to separate how you feel about that original entity, which is kind of my thoughts on Halloween, which I told you. It's hard. It's on the second viewing that I think I can be objective about it. But, I mean, it's an excellently made movie.
Yeah.
And you do get so much interesting witch stuff that you've never really seen before. Politics of witches
and
weird
behind-the-scenes
stuff.
The blood orgy stuff was really cool at the end. I liked where it kind of pushed it with that.
Insane. I guess that you were saying like it's one of the best witch movies you've ever seen. I guess I don't really like witch movies.
That's what
I realized because I'm like, I don't think there's that many witch movies I can really say like, oh, I love that witch movie.
And I thought that's why they had Tilda do the multiple roles was that they were trying to really keep the cast female. Mm. Because the only two males that I could identify were the two inspectors. And they were in there for like 5 seconds,
They had a very minor role in it.
So yeah, it was an entirely female cast. Aside from that,
I'm still processing 2 weeks later.
What's your walkout feeling? Like the walkout? Yeah,
disappointment.
Okay, yeah.
But it wasn't just because I'm deeply connected to the first film emotionally in any kind of way. I mean, I was able to remove myself from that love and just kind of go in with a fresh start. And it's really long.
That was my biggest complaint.
So fucking long.
It didn't feel long to me, but it is long. Like, it makes me not want to watch it again.
The act breaks.
Yeah. Okay.
When they tell you in the opening, in 6 acts and an epilogue, and then when you get to like act 3 comes up on screen, you're like, holy shit, we're not even halfway there.
I felt the length. Like, I ran out of popcorn and I felt the length.
But listen,
there's
really brilliant stuff in it. There's really, really beautiful and brilliant stuff in it. But I agree with you, Elric. I think that Luca was trying to bring so many ideas and so much imagery and so much meaning and thought that along the way, they kind of forgot how to tell a good story as well. Mm. And I wasn't as emotionally connected to that story. And when
it's not streamlined, it keeps jumping to different characters.
Susie comes in, I just felt like there were no stakes involved because Susie comes in and she's very good at what she does. And then when Tilda puts her on the spot and says, do this thing, and she does it. She does it well. Not great, but she does it well. But with a little help from Tilda, she does it great. Mm-hmm. And then it just kept going up and up and up for her as opposed to, you just wanted some pushback. You wanted to know where it was going. I just wanted some more threats and some more stakes. I felt everybody else involved with Susie were a threat, but I'm not emotionally connected to them. I'm supposed to be.
But I think if you watch it, all right, so here's the thing. When it ended and I walked out, my initial 50-50 point was more towards hate rather than like. Yeah. Now that I've sat on it, I liked it, but I interpreted the end totally different than Natasha did. And Natasha like explained what she thought the ending was, and I was like, oh, really? Mm. And then a few days ago, I can share this online, but IndieWire did an excellent interview with the writer.
Yeah.
And Natasha was completely spot on.
Oh, really?
Because the writer explains it. And so the ending has a meaning that changes the entire movie.
Send that to
me. So now when I watch it again, I'm going to think about what...
Yeah.
Is this the plug at the end? Because like after the credits start rolling, you see Susie kind of anointing somebody. And we discussed
like
kind of what that...
We'll talk about it after. But
I thought
it does change everything.
Baptizing somebody. Yeah. So, yeah, I thought that that had some meaning to it.
Yeah. There's a good interview with Luca in the new Fangoria as well that you should read, because he wanted to – the approach that he wanted was to just go in and you automatically knew there are witches and that's what they do.
That's the biggest
The politics of it all. Yeah. You know, and that's what kind of fascinated him a
little bit. Almost more like an Almodovar movie. You know how his movies are always a group of women talking by them. You're like, oh, yeah, I get that.
Yeah.
But it does have some brilliant – I really want to see that one again. Of all the movies I've seen, I mean, before I finalize where it is in my brain.
Yeah.
But the running time really does hurt the rewatch factor.
Well, that's the thing.
That's
a
tough one.
I wanted to go back that weekend, and then I was reminded. It was like, don't forget, that's another 2.5 hours out of this weekend that you're not going to get back. And I was like, you know what? Maybe I rather than immediately race in to take control of my feelings on the movie and try to course correct or, you know, get a new opinion, I'm going to let it marinate for a while. I'll probably revisit it on a Blu-ray.
We should watch it like a show on Blu-ray. Like, six nights, like a miniseries. Like, let's watch each act.
Oh, that's nice.
Once a night.
And record a little episode on each act.
Together and it's like act five minutes long. Okay, that's it.
That's it, guys. We're good.
But it is cool that a lot of people are really loving it. I like seeing those people who it's their favorite movie the year. There's a lot of people are really dialed in. So I think, and it's got enough horror scenes and interesting things for me to maybe get that somewhere, but I don't think I'll ever come around to I feel the same way about that Terrence Malick's Tree of Life. It's like, if I could cut 40 minutes out of it, you've got a genius movie, but as is, I'll never watch it again.
Yeah.
You know,
there's
just too much in there. But anyway, that's cool. And I'd like to hear Natasha's theory later.
Well, it's
the same
it's
one.
Right? Anyway.
It's probably, similar to, I'd be curious. Anyway.
All right. Suspiria. Cool. Nice. What else? What do you got?
Well, I'll jump in because I read what I am now calling my favorite book of the year. And I don't even think it came out this year. I think it's been out for a couple of years. But I read it on a plane. So we screened my movie, All the Creatures Were Stirring, which comes out December 4th on VOD and December 13th.
By the way, congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, December 4th on VOD.
I feel like there'll be a few plugs between now and the release on the show.
December 13th on Shudder. Yeah, you'll hear it a few
times.
But we screened it in my hometown, which was just weird. We screened it at the Alamo Draft House there. Sold out crowd, full of my high school teachers. My parents came, some of my friends from high school. It was just trippy as shit. But while I was flying out there, I read this on the plane, and I had my flight left at like 5 a.m. and I wasn't actually planning on reading much of it. I was planning on sleeping most of the time, and I started it and read the entire thing on the flight, Fantastic Land. And this was given to me by Kyle Clark, who has the This Is Rad podcast, and he does a lot of stuff for the Nerdist. He comes to Horror Trivia with us, and he had handed it to me and said, this is going to be your favorite book of the year. It's gory. Don't eat while you eat it. Don't eat while you read it. And I fucking loved it. The concept of it is that in Orlando, where Disney World and all the other theme parks are, there is Fantastic Land, which has this smaller family-run amusement park, which has been there for 40 years. And there's a hurricane coming. And Fantastic Land, the owners decide that they want to be the first theme park back up and running after the hurricane, that it always takes the theme parks a couple of days to turn over, and that they want to be the first one back up and running. So they offer the employees, most of whom are like teenagers and college students, a crazy amount of money to stay in the park during the hurricane so that they can get the park turned around immediately. And most of them have abandoned cell phones and stuff like that because it's like Disneyland where they don't let you carry them around. Hurricane comes. It's way worse than anybody imagines. They get completely shut off from the rest of the world for 2 or 3 weeks. And then it becomes Lord of the Flies or Battle Royale, kind of a mix of both of them, in the park with college students and teenagers. And they all break off into factions.
Are they stuck there?
They're stuck there. They're completely flooded in. They can't get out. The electricity is out. The only food that they have is what's in the park, and that quickly runs out. immediately people start dying. There's factions. They're dealing with bodies. It gets hyper gory really quick.
Actually sounds like Driving. It's, I mean, in its way, because when I mean, Driving goes surreal. Yeah, by Lansdowne.
This gets surreal. Okay. This gets really surreal. But at the same time, it feels real. It gets really gory and surreal. But at the same time, it feels grounded in reality. It actually feels like genuine human reaction. This was fucking amazing. I am just in love with this book now. So that is Fantastic Land. I looked up the author, Mike Bakhoven. He's based out of Nebraska. I think this is his only book
it's
far.
It's Bakhoven, Bakhoven, not Coven. Like oven. I'm just kidding.
But, I don't know.
It's an American movie reference.
And immediately, I was immediately like, this would make an amazing movie. Who owns the rights to this? And apparently, a lot of people are trying to get the rights to this to make a movie. As soon as I looked it up online,
it was
like.
Yeah, but Ryan just got them right then.
All, right now. He just did it on his phone.
He was like, boom. All
right now.
Done.
He has a new book called Pack that came out this year.
Oh, excellent. Now I'm going to have to get that one. But this was just super tight, super horrifying. I could not put it down the entire time on the plane, and it was 5 a.m. on a Monday. So really good. Fantastic Land.
Cool.
I got a couple British movies.
We'd like to borrow now.
I'll take it.
I'm passing to Ryan.
I don't know if Ryan's seen this one at the festival. I saw a film called Possum.
Oh yeah. That is my next talking point.
Was it really?
Oh, really?
It is. Yeah, I saw it this
to
morning.
Hear
I
rented you guys
it. I rented
think.
It too. Weirdly enough, I rented.
Oh, did you?
And you watched it?
I saw it at Fright Fest.
Ah.
And walked out.
Ah. Okay. See,
and
that's
she told
where
me
I
she
am.
Starts on it.
I wasn't. I watched this a while ago.
Becca's got a picture of an opossum pulled up on her.
I pulled it up on my computer, and a possum came.
Wait, are we
up.
Talking about the same film? It's an animated film about a cute little possum. It's so beautiful.
It is. It is.
Not that film.
That's what she's got.
Or are we talking about British miserabilism?
British miserabilism.
Every shot is just
that is the best subgenre.
Yeah, that is. That is spot on. I have never walked out of a movie in my entire life.
How long did you stand? How long were you in it though?
At least an hour.
Oh, okay.
Then you did. We're almost there, and you know, you're in England in the middle of 800 movies, and you're like, you know what? I'd rather eat right now.
Yeah. So
it's only an hour 25, by
I
the way.
You missed like 20 minutes. Last week, Ryan was watching it in his office.
Yeah.
I went home and rented it that night. I turned it off after about 20 minutes,
what?
Which is why I had not planned to talk about it on the show. Because
usually, but anyway, you go, Elric. This seems right up your alley. Yeah, for sure.
This does seem like a you movie.
Actually, no. That's right. Look, I respect it. I think it was well made. I think the performances are really good, but it was just a little too depressing for me and a little too nothing.
Well, this would have made a fantastic short.
Oh, no, the whole time I thought it was
great.
I was putting
film.
Money on it going, this probably was a short that he got to adapt later after he made a great short. No, there's some aesthetic qualities to the direction that's really good, but at no point am I invested in watching the suffering character. The puppet thing is very interesting. Just to give people some reference at home, it's a guy who returns home. He doesn't look quite right. He looks like a troubled, like 40, 50-year-old man with a bag, and inside the bag is this giant spider puppet, and it's really interesting looking.
Ventriloquist.
Possum.
Yeah, named Possum. And he's got this interesting child fable that goes with it that he kind of wrote as a kid. And he's coming back to his mom's house. His mom's passed, and her husband is still there, which is a stepdad who's a guy you'd recognize from every British movie, especially things like Braveheart. Mm-hmm. And the performances are really interesting, but it is so unpleasant. I even have a threshold. I like art house horror, but this to me was so unpleasant. I watched the whole thing, and I don't regret it, and I think it's an interesting movie. I don't think it's a good horror movie. I think it often will give you these really cool aesthetic moments where it's building to that moment and then never deliver on that. Yeah. And that's a little too much for me. But I thought it was interesting.
It's extended scenes of a character walking around very bleak landscapes.
Suffering. He's always suffering.
Always
on screen.
Oh, no. All the
he doesn't
close-ups.
Change,
it's the actor from Prometheus. He was the Mohawk guy.
Sean Harris.
I kept assuming he's in Game of Thrones. I was like, yeah, I bet you he's
I'm
in
sure
Game
he was. But
there.
Yeah, it was. It's a very depressing experience. And the funny thing is, I went on Rotten Tomatoes and I just wanted to see the reviews, and it's like 98%. Like 98%
okay,
like people. And I started reading some of the reviews, which was giving me a little insight into what the filmmaker was going for and what the film was going for. But again, it just wasn't my cup of tea, because a kind of pontification about, like, abuse
they didn't actually go all the way.
They didn't go all the way.
There's one scene
that
starts to go all the way towards the end, and I'm like, no, you could. And it's rare that I go, a movie needs flashbacks.
Yeah.
But this film could have actually, like, it could have helped.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, it's an interesting movie. Some people, I read one guy I post on our Shockwaves Facebook, and he sent us his favorite film
on Twitter and Facebook. There
which
was
is
a listener that recommended it, like, highly to all of us.
Yeah, and I wouldn't say you're not wrong, because it's a well crafted movie. It's better than liking something that's a piece of shit that, but it's a very very hard film to love. Yeah.
So I was so excited when I saw Ryan watching this, and I went and researched it. Matthew Holness, the guy who wrote it and directed it, was Garth Marenghi.
Oh, that's why everyone talks about this movie.
Yeah.
And I absolutely love him.
He did a ton of work on The Mighty Boosh.
Yeah, no, he's
And immediately he's I genius. Was like, yeah. holy shit, this guy is genius. I'm going to love this. Garth Marenghi was amazing.
Yes, but the big difference there is humor.
Humor.
This has no humor.
None.
And by robbing the quality you have most in your work, which is humor, because he's amazing, that guy. Yeah. That really changes my whole perspective on it.
Garth Marenghi is so good. And The Mighty Boosh, like, I own all the Mighty Boosh and rewatched
But Marenghi is like one of the greatest horror things ever created.
Ever.
It's hilarious.
Which is a shame because it's never had a good release here in the U.S.
No, yeah,
I have
some
the UK DVD.
Oh, I'm glad you pointed that out because that does make it an interesting. But anyway, the polar opposite. I went to AFI Fest yesterday and just absolutely felt, oh, it's going to be one of my favorite films of the year. I don't know if it would be one of my favorite horror films because it's so unclassifiable. And that is Peter Strickland's new film, In Fabric,
which I just loved.
The soundtrack, I noticed. You mentioned soundtrack. Soundtrack's definitely one of the best of the year. It's so playful. It's even more playful. Like, it gets more playful as the movie goes. The first half is, it's almost, you could call it a horror, kind of an anthology.
It is an anthology.
Because it's like following a haunted dress. And it gets so weird. So this is the director of a number of films I've probably talked about in Pure Cinema. But Duke of Burgundy is a masterpiece of just modern, strange filmmaking. And the best word, what I tweeted about, is like, psychotronic has never been, a word has never suited a director more. He made Barbarian Sound Studio, which I didn't love, but that was interesting. And then before that, his first film is this revenge film, hard to get here, but it's actually his best film, called Katrina Varga, and it's brilliant. So this is a very interesting director. You've got this woman who's kind of got a son at home, and she works in a bank, and it seems like it's set in the real world at the start. The first 10 minutes, I'm like, oh, she works in a bank. And then as the movie goes, beyond the haunted dress stuff, which is a minor part of it, really, and the haunted dress killing people, that's just one part of it. But it's the surreal interactions with the bankers. And they were like, oh, tell us your story. Her boss
is,
tell us about your dreams.
Oh,
and then
yeah,
the department store has all these surreal, they seem like witches from the original Suspiria. Basically.
They feel like witches like run by...
It's a weird
patriarch of some sort.
It's really, when I say unclassifiable, it's rare for me to say that about that movie. I just wouldn't even know what bracket. So I bet you will make my top 10 films of the year, but probably won't be on our Shockwaves list because I just don't know if I could commit to it.
Yeah, it's one of those movies that I saw at a festival and I couldn't get
it out
of my
head.
I think it was Fantastic Fest 2. And I didn't realize that it was actually playing at AFI last night. Yeah. I just had the theme.
It was during the day.
There was a theme that popped, the main kind of theme during the mannequin ritual thing, just kind of popped in my head. And I was like, I really want to find that. And you can't even find the composer info online anywhere.
Oh, interesting.
Which is really
Strickland's interesting. Interesting because he's British and he was a critic and stuff initially, and then he started making movies. But he lives in Hungary and he's lived in Hungary his entire career. And they were like, "Sorry, Peter couldn't be here because he's in some small town in Hungary." Like, that's unusual. But this movie has some very unusual scenes, like them washing a mannequin and then getting very sexually erotically charged with mannequin. You're kind of like Spasmo. You're like, "What is going on?" But where it lands in some really kind of broad, weird comedy in the last act, and by the end of the movie, I was like, "This is a weird movie." But I really got the vibe that everyone in the theater loved it because it was totally unusual. And Ben Wheatley is a producer on it. Yep. So it has kind of all these new British filmmakers. And, you know, I've always thought Britain struggled with genre for a long time and was very uninteresting. And then largely because funding bodies wouldn't fund horror. Right. Now you've actually got these voices popping up and there's some really interesting directors. So I highly recommend, this is going to be an A24 release whenever it happens. It's going to come out. But those two films couldn't be more different, but they happen to be British and I thought might as well put them together.
Yeah.
Cool. I've been delving into some Warner Archive stuff. I'm glad that they finally opened up their library and are doing Blu-ray releases because they've done a lot of great stuff in the past, whether it be The Hidden or Wolfen or The Hunger and stuff like that. And so I saw three. I'm just going to go through them really quick. The first one they just released is Bad Ronald, which is the TV movie.
Yeah.
You've never seen it before?
No, I think I have the disc. I've been hearing people talk about it. Because in New Zealand, we didn't really get your TV movies. Mm-hmm. So all these kind of cool American horror TV movies, I haven't seen any of them.
Yeah, it's really interesting. It's a 1974 made-for-TV movie. It was the first time I heard about it was from Judah Friedlander, you know, the comedian, because he's a big horror fan. And so he was the one. He's like, "You ever see Bad Ronald, man?" I was like, "No." And it was also – the plot of it was what I wished the Black Christmas remake was, because that sounded so cool. And you've probably heard it before because movies have redone it. But, I mean, the super short version is Ronald – is kind of this awkward, nerdy guy that lives in a house with his mother. He's got a very strange, close relationship with his mother. He's out and about and gets in a fight, an argument with a little girl, pushes her over, and she basically cracks her head on the concrete and dies. And so he runs home, and his mom insists, like, no, we have to hide you so that the police don't ever find you. Let's just box up this room in the house, and you could just, like, hide out in there. And so he does. And then she goes for surgery and dies and never comes home.
Oh, my God.
And so Ronald never leaves the walls. Instead, Daphne Coleman moves in with his three daughters.
Okay. And they're I did not know he was in this.
Yeah.
I haven't seen this in so long. You're making me want to watch it again.
Yeah, and so it's this weird, bizarre thing where it's like the daughters are convinced that they're being watched or there's some weird thing going on in the house. And it is. It's Ronald. He's just like hiding in the walls and stuff. And it's so bizarre. This Blu-ray looks – I mean, I've always seen it like as bootleg or taped off TV. It is flawless. It is a flawless digital HD version of Bad Ronald. And there's nothing much more to it than that. Like, it's just a weird movie.
I bought it on DVD at the – when I got back, I talked a little bit about it. The thing that cracks me up is like he comes back from this murder or this accidental murder. Yeah. And then his mom, her immediate plan is – we got to put you in the wall.
Yeah.
And then she fills up the pantry, builds this wall, does this thing. And there's no time. Like, she doesn't wait for the cops to come. She just immediately goes, Ronald, get in the wall.
Yeah.
And then the cops come by, like, maybe the next day. And they're like, hey, there's a report of a missing girl. Meanwhile, Ronald could have just spent some time with his mom saying goodbye. I don't know.
It's
really funny.
Yeah. There's no, like, let's just say it's an accident. It's like, nope, in the wall. Got to hide you. And it's really funny. The guy that plays Ronald is named Scott Jacoby. And he kind of looks like Matthew Modine. He's got like the glass, like the nerdy glasses and stuff. And he did a lot of acting, but he directed – I was so fascinated by this. He directed one thing in 2001, a documentary called Rage, 20 Years of Punk Rock West Coast Style. And I just think it's kind of awesome that – Bad Ronald directed a punk rock documentary.
Actually, that's a great name for a punk band. It's just Bad Ronald.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
I would be all in on Bad Ronald.
I always wonder, like Bad Boy Bubby, which I know is Australian, feels so much like this, but it's more of a comedic version of it.
Well, that was about the mother.
Yeah.
Like traps the guy in the room, tells him outside world is like there's an apocalypse, you can never go out. So he's like a 50-year-old man who's never gone outside.
Oh, he sleeps
with his mom and he learns things like he's insane and eventually she dies. Ugh. So he goes outside and the adventures he has. It's one of the funniest, weirdest cult movies I've ever seen.
But it feels like if you watch it,
maybe you never know
them.
That idea might have come from something like that, you know?
Wow. Yeah.
There's some crazy, that's the thing, there's some crazy fucking movies out there that have been made over the years.
It's so funny. I'll have to upgrade. I mean, like the Blu-ray, if the Blu-ray is.
It's, I mean, it's like, I put it on, I couldn't believe how good it looked.
And it's really short too, isn't it? Like an hour?
Yeah, it's like 78, it's like 80 minutes.
It's made for TV movie.
We got to get, as a guest, if she's ever out here, Amanda Reyes, so we can get all the, she has all the TV movie recs.
Oh, yeah.
That would just be a fun one for me because I don't know so much of those things. You know?
Yeah. Another release that they put out was The Swarm, which I've never seen. But as Ryan knows, there's 8 billion copies of the soundtrack at every record store we go to.
It's a swarm of records.
I made a lot of poor decisions this week in terms of like
life
decisions. Like Suspiria was almost every movie I picked is 2.5 hours long.
Oh, yeah.
And The Swarm has the audacity to be 2 hours and 35 minutes long.
Wow. Oh, come on.
It's really long.
Oh, my God.
And
Irwin Allen.
It makes sense. It's Irwin Allen who did The Poseidon Adventure, The Towering Inferno.
Yeah.
This stars Michael Caine. It's got like an all-star cast. It is just Richard Chamberlain, ridiculously long for no reason other than that was what he was doing at the time.
Yeah.
And the problem is it's bees. So whereas like The Poseidon Adventure, the book gets flipped, it's, you know, The Towering Inferno, it's a fire. It is impossible to take seriously Michael Caine doing his best to convince you.
I'm stung.
These bees are dangerous. These bees are dangerous. You know, it's like, that's it. They're just invading towns.
Jared does a good impersonation of it.
Yeah. What year is it? How close is it to him in The Revenge? Is it like
1978.
Yeah, this is 78.
So it's what, like 6 years before something?
It's when audiences wanted event horror movies with bees.
Yeah.
And they're wrong. It says here on IMDb that it's an hour and 56 minutes. No, it is 2 hours and 35 minutes. Ooh. I know because I watched the whole damn thing.
I wonder if there's different cuts. Maybe there is a shorter cut.
It's the longest cut ever.
Extended cut.
Yeah.
So The Swarm, I can't exactly recommend, but it is an experience if you want to spend it, you know, wasting a Saturday morning like I did.
Are people just being killed by being stung? Is that it? Or is there more
to it?
No,
it's like a swarm of bees that literally just like, I don't even know what they're doing. I guess they suffocate you.
Okay.
But it's like wide scale. It's not like they kill like three people. Like they take out like cities, if I remember correctly.
Well, it opens where they basically take out a whole military base.
Yeah.
And so it's like, but like everybody's dead, but they're not like, you know, like stung or falling apart. They just look like they had a heart attack or something. You're like, what happened here?
Yeah.
And that's where Michael Caine mysteriously appears and he's like, I've been following this all along and you know, whatever else.
If you want to see a good bee killing movie, you watch Crush with Alicia Silverstone. There's one good scene in there where she comes up with a bee murder. And I was always impressed with that.
I like it in Anaconda.
Is there a bee murder in that?
Doesn't he get something stuck in one of his... I thought it was a bee, that he gets a bee in his trachea and it's...
Wait, somebody dies from a bee in an anaconda movie? What the hell?
I swear.
You have a giant anaconda. What's wrong
with it? Oh, yeah.
Am I right?
He gets something that...
Well,
it's
wasn't
like stuck. It's like in like a rebreather. There's like a bee in it because you're supposed to think that somebody may have put it
well,
in there.
Well, tweet us your favorite bee murders.
I was going to say, my favorite bee murder is My Girl.
Okay.
That did mess me up.
That's so sad.
And last but not least, they also did an incredible job on the original Village of the Damned, which I had never seen, the 1960 version.
Yeah, that's a good
movie. I'd seen the Carpenter one, which I actually do like. First of all, black and white stuff looks gorgeous in Blu-ray. Yeah. I didn't realize how closely this followed. I didn't realize how closely Carpenter's follows the original. Yeah. Which basically is this mysterious thing happens to a town where everybody passes out, and then when they wake up, everyone that was in that town is pregnant. And their children years later turn out to be a bunch of very strange, cherub-like, blonde-haired devils, if you will. So,
I think Carpenters could have worked in Black Knight because it's some of the effects that don't quite work. But if you just flipped it, maybe it could have been.
Yeah,
fine,
I think so. And I mean, they extend, you know, obviously Carpenter's a little bit longer and they do some more graphic murders and stuff like that, but I was just so impressed with how much this film stands up still. And again, we're talking.
Who the director is? He doesn't ring a bell to me.
Wolf Rilo?
No.
But again, 1960. I always put into context. This is the same year that Psycho came out. I don't know anything else that this director did. I can't recommend this Blu-ray enough. Village of the Damned original.
Did you get the Draculas?
Not yet. That's next on my list now that I've gotten
these
three.
Sitting in my Amazon box. And I'm
Speaking of Draculas, I saw a post by Becca on Instagram of a book called What the Hell Was
Dracutwig. Which
every time I looked at that, I laughed out loud because I didn't know what the hell it is.
I bought it.
What is it?
I bought it.
What is it?
It is. I haven't read it yet because I just purchased it last night.
It did make me laugh, and it's
but
rare that
it was a Dracutwig. Dracula. It's Dracula's daughter who has the body of Twiggy because that was really entrancing.
Yeah, she was the big
during
model,
that time, and she turns into a vampire whenever she has sex.
It's the worst title. So I couldn't even say the word aloud. Every time I looked at the book,
as soon as I looked at it, I was like Dracutwig. Like it took me forever to figure it out what it was trying to say, but I got that. I was on Doug Loves Movies last night.
Oh, cool.
The Doug Benson podcast.
Is that a recorded thing? Yeah, okay.
They recorded it last night. It actually just came out today, which is Wednesday. So by the time this show comes out on Friday, you can definitely hear it. And I was on with Eli Roth and a couple of other people.
Did you tell him what I think about the first half of Knock Knock?
I left that out.
Big fan.
I should have just walked up and been
up.
Like,
I love that first half of Knock Knock.
We'll hopefully have him in January.
Yeah,
I'll tell him in person.
He even mentioned he was going to be joining us in a couple of weeks. Okay. So hopefully we can tell him in person. But it was a blast. I did movie trivia and they play a lot of games, which we should do occasionally because it was a blast. They
what
do
kind
like
of games?
Last Man Standing was the one that we did last night where they will literally go round robin. So like last night it was Jamie Lee Curtis and Stan Lee. Mm-hmm. And everyone like they would start with Rob and you have to name movies until you can't name
movies. Oh, I think Beyond Fish kind of did that with Cronenberg cameos
they
or something.
They did.
Yeah,
and right. And you have to do it until you can't name anymore and the last man standing wins the game. Mm-hmm. I was not the last, it should be last person standing, I was not the last person, but I was, for Stan Lee, I was able to pull out some definite deep cuts that nobody else knew, like Princess Diaries 2. Hmm. Thank you, my five-year-old. So I found that book at the bookstore next to Upright Citizens Brigade.
Nice.
Which was very cool. So I will be reading that soon.
Cool. Well, tell us all about it one day. Did you watch anything else?
I did. Well, I caught up. So last week I told you guys that I was enjoying that show on Hutter on Hulu, Light as a Feather, Stiff as a Board. which I had only watched like 4 episodes of the time. I watched the rest of it, all 10 episodes. I loved it, and it has gotten such shitty ratings. So I encourage others to watch to see if there might be something there. Like the critical reviews were not good. Ryan, did you check it out?
We talked about it. Yeah. I think when I talked about it, I was 2 episodes in. I'm up to 5, but I need to finish. I need to finish Sabrina.
Yeah, I got two more episodes. I haven't
started it. Have you started?
I only did the first episode so far. I'm way behind.
Yeah, I did the first episode.
You guys like it?
I fucking love it.
I mean, I'd watch it anyway for Axel, but I want to watch it because I, you know,
I mean, the look of the show, the characters.
Okay, cool. It's fun. I watched the first episode. I haven't started Hill House yet. I am so behind on everything.
That was the other thing. I saw those articles about Overlord. I haven't seen Overlord yet, but people were like, oh, maybe it's doing good with horror people, but not other people. And I'm just like, but it's also you're releasing it like right after Halloween, where it's like, we're all kind of, you get a little burned out right after Halloween. That, to me, it seems like a really weird time to release a movie, personally. Yeah. I don't know.
Well, I'm assuming that they didn't want to compete with everything else that's going on.
But even so, it's just like I even don't really want to go to a movie right the weekend after Halloween. You're kind of, I don't know.
Yeah, you do.
Do I?
Yeah, you do.
I want to go to a movie, just not necessarily a horror movie. I don't know.
But if you're kind of into your teenage horror, I'll call it like Riverdale with a really strong supernatural edge to it. Check out Light as a Feather. I'm really enjoying it, and no one else is watching it, and the people who are don't seem to like it very much.
Yeah.
Yeah, Ryan's on it too, so there's something there. There's something that's kind of trapped me in. Yeah.
Did any of you see What Keeps You Alive? Colin Minahan's movie. Mm-mm. He's one half of the Butcher Brothers, and now they're all separately doing their own thing.
I know who they are, but I haven't seen
it. It's a pretty good thriller. It's a pretty good thriller, kind of cabin in the woods scenario. A couple by the name Jackie and Jules. They're a married couple who go off to the cabin. I think it's Jackie who one of her ex-girlfriends is living across the lake, and her wife is kind of already on guard and a little bit paranoid because she's discovering that there are things about her wife that she never knew about. And in the first 20 minutes, Jackie Chiller like literally pushes her wife off a cliff and leaves her for dead. And then the rest of the film is about Jules coming back and trying to, one, nurse her wounds and survive the evening, but also find out why she tried to kill her, why Jackie tried to kill her. And it's pretty solid. It's a solid little thriller. I think that thematically I couldn't kind of key into exactly what Colin's statement was. I like that it's a married female couple. I like that it was taking those gender expectations and turning them on their head and throwing us through a kind of a basic revenge tale. At the very end, though, I just wanted something. I wanted like a punctuation mark of like, this is why, you know. But it looks beautiful. The acting's terrific. The score is especially good. So it's on all the VOD services now. But if you want something a little bit different, check it out.
What's it called again?
What Keeps You Alive.
What Keeps You Alive.
Yeah.
If you want to see something that's not different. I had not seen this since I was a wee one, and I loved this movie when I was a kid. The movie doesn't hold up, but the monster still does. I saw The Unnamable.
I visited Miskatonic U,
and I mean, when I say I was a big fan, this was just like one of those movies I loved renting as a kid, and I love the creature. She's still great. I used her in our, what was that episode we did where we created our monster squads? She was one of my key monsters, my outside the box monster. This just came out on Blu-ray by, I don't know if it's Vestron or who it was sent to me.
MVD?
Yeah, MVD. You're right. Yeah. They just sent them out. I don't know how I got on that list for MVD, but it must have been a while ago. But I was really excited, and the cover's awesome. They really kicked ass with the cover art. And it's just funny because it is about as routine a horror film as you could possibly come up. It's just really, hey, there's a house, let's go in it, and then one by one gets separate. I mean, there's no twist, no subversive equality. It's just exactly what it is. That said, there's some fun scenes. The creature still looks awesome. It's really fun to watch sweaters that say Miskatonic U. I mean, and they go to the university. They actually go to Miskatonic University. It's all about Lovecraft, really, and they go to Miskatonic University, and there's like 4 extras. It's clearly a university campus that was closed, and it's hilarious just how closed it all looks.
Right.
you know, I don't know. I don't know if I'd necessarily rush to. I was personally, as a big fan of this film, I was pretty disappointed with the movie this time. Just kind of like, oh yeah, I could half watch it. But every time the creature would come up, I'd be like, oh yeah, that's pretty badass. And she still looks great. And there's a great shot where the guy's on the ground, she's in the background, and she looks fucking ginormous because she's got these weird hoof legs, which are still really cool.
Leg warmers.
Yeah, they do look like furry leg warmers. But I don't really know the point of the myth. I don't think they ever really get into anything about the, like, in that Lovecraft lore that's just so simple. Yeah. Which is a little disappointing. So, but it's cool that it's on Blu-ray now, and I no longer have to think about it in VHS terms. So,
wow.
So there it is.
Wow. Did you get Return of Swamp Thing?
The unnameable. I didn't.
Yeah, because Christmas is coming up, and and I am a resident Return of Swamp Thing
Wernowski
lover,
fan.
So,
if I get that, I will keep an eye out.
Please let me know.
That's a great one.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's the one with what's her name from Melrose Place, right?
Yeah,
Heather Locklear
comes in.
Yeah, that's right. That's a fun one.
They have their sex scene where he's like, "Well, I can't have sex with you, but I have this thing, chew on this," and it's like a little nub of vegetable. Do you remember this?
Vaguely.
I don't.
I just remember that as a kid. It was like, he was like, well, we can't
really
do it.
You sure you didn't make that up as a kid?
No. Yes, my 14-year-old self was just like, how does Swamp Thing have sex?
Well, if Toxie can do it, then.
Elric,
you want to talk about Next of Kin? Because I just got that Blu-ray, and you just talked about it on your other show.
Yeah, we got it from a friend of ours.
Oh, Mick Carroll. Yeah. Bless you, Mick.
I feel bad.
So
I forgot his name when I was doing the other show, so I didn't want to try to butcher it. It just went. I knew it was Mick, and I was like, I don't remember. So I just.
Mick is the gentleman that a Texas Frightmare came came walking over with hands full of beer for us.
Bloody Aussies.
And now he sent us Blu-rays.
Oh, and I was going to say Next of Kin is the Australian horror.
One we were telling
right?
you that's, about, that's kind of, you know, it's got Argento-ish vibes. It's definitely European art house vibes mixed with, like, you know, real horror. It's really fun to see John Jarrett in there, especially handsome. So John Jarrett, you know, the killer
is
handsome, well-spoken. And
young.
I mean, he's probably 25 or something.
Oh, wow.
And he's well-spoken. So
I didn't recognize him until after
But also it's
fact.
His voice, because I think you think of his accent as Mick as like this prototypical dumb Aussie bad guy. And then this, he just sounds like anyone.
Yeah.
Anyway, I'd be curious because, I mean, I did talk about it on the show because it's a movie I really love it. There's something about it that just doesn't feel like other movies except for maybe Let's Scare Jessica, those kinds of
I liked it. I didn't love it, but I liked it a lot, and there's definitely some interesting sequences, especially the finale. Like
the last
20 minutes is what makes it really as great as it is. But yeah, it's featured in Not Quite Hollywood.
Yeah,
And
directed by a Kiwi. That's
directed by
part.
A Kiwi. I know, New Zealand Williamson, director for Australia. And there's a quote on the cover that like Quentin Tarantino like compares it to like having scarier sequences than The Shining. And
that comparison.
But I get the Shining reference.
Shining and Lynch. It has those vibes.
Yeah, Shining and the Lynch because the aesthetic. What's the basic premise of the girl in this house?
It's this huge estate
where
her mother, where she grew up there, and her mother turned it in, when her father died, I guess, turned it into a home for the elderly.
It
becomes a retirement home, and I guess before the movie opens, the woman dies. And so we start this movie with a young woman in her 20s coming home and now being she was at uni, and now she's responsible in this remote town for all these people. Now, does she sell it and kick them all out, or does she keep running it? And she probably doesn't want to run this kind of place, and she's trying to like date a guy she used to date, and it's all fairly standard, but he's got these details, like where she's building like little things from sugar cubes. There's a scene towards the end, she's making sugar cubes in a diner, and the boy at the diner, there's just these, and these little drowning underwater slow motion scenes.
That stuff's great.
So somebody starts knocking off the residents of this retirement village, and nothing cheesy or funny. It's not that kind of, it's not campy at all. It's all done very straight. But there's one sequence I was wondering if you would agree that the kind of shock, something comes flying towards you. It really reminded me of the doll in Deep Red coming towards you. He must have seen Deep Red, but I don't know if he did. It's around the same time.
Is it?
I
mean, no, this was 80. Oh, was it? When was Deep Red?
This would be a little bit after Deep Red. Deep Red's like 77 or something.
Maybe.
So it could be, but he talks on the extras about only European art films that he didn't really talk about horror. He's talking about Bertolucci and it's a really strange gem, and the guy never got to make another horror film, and you know, Australia doesn't make a lot of horror films like that that are atmosphere and dread over plot.
Yeah.
And that's probably why I loved it, is because I'd never seen something down under really like that.
Yeah.
Babadook now would be the closest to that, but even that's more overt, you know?
Yeah.
But I think this is region free, so you guys, the only bummer is you have to, you know, order it from Australia, but I do hope people do it.
I don't know if this is true, so forgive me, but because this is Umbrella, who is doing great work, and it's all region free stuff.
Yeah.
They did Silver Bullet and Orca. Somebody told me that Severin is doing the U.S. version of this.
Well, that would make a lot of sense because it also has Changeling vibes for
sure. Yeah, yeah. But I think somebody just tweeted at me saying, oh, did you know Severin's putting it out here? So I don't know if they announced it or not. Don't quote me.
Yeah.
But I think there is. I mean, yes, you can get the Australian one if you have access to it. I know Diabolik actually carries a lot of the Umbrella stuff.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'd be shocked if you didn't love this one.
Okay.
I would guess you would. And I think you'll think that's really interesting. Yeah, just because it's surprising.
It's interesting. Yeah. It's definitely very interesting. Yeah.
But I'm glad you got it. I'm really glad we got those copies free.
Yeah.
That's
the
best part.
Next of kin.
Yeah, next of kin. Really
cool movie. A beer, Mick. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mick.
So I'll talk about one more that I checked out. Come Back to Me from 2014. Yeah, and I doubt any of you guys have seen this because it was a real small release.
It's on Netflix,
through,
maybe?
I don't think so. It's through a company called Freestyle Releasing. And I found it because two of my favorite people in the world, Josh Friedman, who was my assistant director, and Buzz Wellick, who was my producer on the made-for-TV movie I just did, they worked on this. And so knowing, you know, that I'm always looking for horror deep cuts, they told me, they were like, go watch this. It's not perfect, but it's got some really interesting stuff to it. And I have to agree. It's not a perfect movie. There's parts that I wish that they had done differently with it. And there's parts where you can really kind of see the seams of the budget. But there is something really interesting to it. And it's gotten I was reading all the reviews. It's gotten awful reviews, except for Dread Central, who said there's definitely something interesting going on here. The concept is this married couple. They're suburbanites. They live in this beautiful house. That's the one. Elric just pulled up the picture. That every night the wife has blackouts and wakes up and can't remember what's going on, but she has flashes of what may have happened. Sometimes there's blood. Sometimes there isn't. She wakes up in different places around the house, but she keeps having these blackouts. And so they install a camera to see what's going on. And I won't go past that because
that is a plot that I've seen. And I don't know if it's that movie or a different movie.
It goes to a place I swear you have never seen before.
Okay.
And it's based off a book, and I'm not even going to say the title of the book because the title of the book kind of gives away the twist. But it's just a really, really cool concept that I had not seen before. And again, the movie has some scars to it, but it's an interesting concept that I at least want to mention because I'd never seen it before. So that is Come Back to Me from 2014, directed by Paul Leyden. He's like an actor. He had done a lot of soap operas and stuff like that. This was definitely an interesting movie. I would be interested to read the story that it's based off of.
The last 20 years have yielded a lot of really interesting movies like this that have gone direct-to-video. And I think we really should do an episode that are kind of like super deep cut or overlooked films.
Yeah.
Because there was a Colin Hanks movie where he was a
Alone
stalker.
With her.
Alone with her.
I love that movie.
Movies
so
like
good.
That, we should start putting spotlight on a little bit
I
more.
I know Rob and I are both fans of Little Erin Meriwether, which is like another one where you can see the seams of the budget, but it's clear that the director's doing something really fascinating.
A little rough
with
around
it.
The edges, but because there's a Christopher Denham movie that I really like that's very much in the vein of Alone with Her. But we should round up some titles like that and maybe do something.
Yeah.
You know, because I think that these come up every once in a while. And then when you look at when they came out, and it almost feels like they came out of the 90s, but it's like 2003, 2005, and you're like, whoa, wait a second. They still feel really fresh.
Yeah.
We should
Colin was on Dexter, and he came in to do the Dexter podcast, and he was blown away when I name dropped that movie.
Yeah.
I was like, dude, that was...
Completely got buried.
Yeah. Really, really cool movie.
That dude ripped my ticket in New Zealand when King Kong came on. He was the ticket usher, and he even wore the blazer.
Which doesn't
surprise me. We all just went line, and he was just there, and I was like, you're calling... Hey. Yeah. I was like, that's pretty cool.
I can't even remember the name now, but Elric, I know you're a fan of it as well. There's a low-budget vampire movie where the vampirism presents itself as a skin disease.
Midnight Sun. Yeah, we talked about Tom Holland.
And that's another one that I'm like, it's small. It got buried really quickly.
It definitely got a release.
Really good.
I had that director on Inside Horror, so he definitely, I don't know if he's made something since, but that's a good little movie. Yeah, you're right. Cool.
I will say that I watched Jason Goes to Hell on Halloween
Unrated.
Eve.
You mean one of the greatest Friday?
I'm bringing it up
because I know that you would have something.
Wait, Rob, what does that make you think of when I say Jason Voorhees? What do you think of?
A little girl putting a donut.
pretty close.
Yeah.
Can we phone an AJ?
I don't reach for that one often.
I can see
why. Was it unrated? That's a very important part.
I watched it in a Blu-ray box set. So I will say I'm not as harsh on it as I once was, because there is a little, there is a modicum of entertainment value in it. I completely forgot that, and honestly, I haven't seen it in like 10 years. I completely forgot that every time he like looks in a mirror, it's Jason, and then Jason's looking in the mirror, and he's like, "Oh," he's like, "That's me.
That's what I look like.
That's what I look like." But I also forgot that when the SWAT team comes down on him and they're blowing him away, he's doing a lot of grunting, of like, "Ooh, bullets."
Kane really,
Guys,
you ready? Becca's gonna kill me. This is just for you. This is the haiku that I wrote for trivia last month that really made her mad.
Awful.
And I think you're going to get this one.
No, wait. The haiku, this one, haikus were okay.
My haikus were okay.
Your limericks didn't rhyme.
Somehow I think Ryan's going to guess it.
And therefore we're not limericks.
This is because we hosted Trapped by my own tropes, taste the blackness of my heart, the dagger will do. Guess the movie.
Oh, it's Jason. Yes, the
there
hell.
You go.
Wow.
Anyway,
see, that
I thought it was classy. Not many. No. One group got it.
That one wasn't bad, but he wrote limericks and they didn't rhyme, which makes them not limericks.
I will make these available on my blog. And then we'll see.
And also, I saw somewhere on under our bold horror statements thing, somebody was like blogger or podcaster say tropes a lot. And I was like,
that's
ding.
Me.
Tropes.
I will say, Jason Goes to Hell is a good
fucking rad.
It's super rad, but it's also a perfect representation of early 90s. It's like,
totally.
Where do you go from there after, you know, Jason Takes Manhattan? You want to wrap it up. You start bringing in family. You start bringing in dark dealings with whatever. You do what
just
you can.
Just make it fun.
You do what you can.
Well,
it's much more fun than Jason on a boat. That's for damn sure. So
I've turned around on that one,
what?
Too.
Not on the first half, though. The first half.
No, once he gets to New York,
I'm in.
New York part's fun.
Overall, I just like the Friday
13th. Oh, last thing I want to mention that I've been enjoying in the Into the Dark series, which is the Hulu series through Blumhouse. Obviously, our guest did the first film, The Body.
Can I watch it if I don't have Hulu?
What's that?
You got two questions.
It's on Hulu.
Okay. It's
no, you can't.
Only on Hulu.
What is the second film they released?
It was called Flesh and Blood from Patrick Lussier. And it's really cool. It's basically, to summarize, it's kind of like The Stepfather, but a la from a father and daughter perspective as opposed to a husband and wife.
Yeah.
And I thought it was really cool. It's just a tight little thriller. That's
simple
exactly that. Like
thriller,
the daughter lost her mom in a terrible, violent way. She lives alone with her dad. She's got a lot of anxieties and can't really leave her house without blacking out and basically agoraphobic.
Mm-hmm.
And then she just starts to suspect that maybe her dad is not who she thinks he is. And so it becomes very stepfather-esque.
Okay.
So it's really cool. And again, I like...
Wait, what's the holiday for this one?
Thanksgiving.
Thanksgiving, cool. Oh, so I should, watch that. Okay, maybe I'll get Hulu again just for a little while or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, they're going to do these once a month, so...
Hey, you could catch up on Inside Number 9 while you're there.
next month pushing. It's always the first Friday of every month, and next month is Nacho Vigalondo's Puka.
Ooh. Oh, well, yeah.
Oh, nice.
For Nacho, I would do it.
And then Sophia to Call...
On Chelsea at some point, right? Or not?
What's that? Chelsea at some point. Yeah, Sophia Tichall, who did a film called Always Shine, it's on.
I've seen that. Which is actually similar to the plot of the story she was just talking about with the... Oh, no, that you were just talking about a woman pushing another woman.
Yes,
their
yes, yes, yes.
Always
yes.
Shine has
absolutely.
A very similar structure.
You're absolutely right.
And I was trying to remember the title as you're talking, and it was out of my brain.
Yes.
She was an actor, too, Sophia Tichall.
Uh-huh.
Mumblecore actress, Cool.
All right, let's
go get our guest.
All right, we'll be right back.
Tonight's Shockwaves is brought to you by Shudder, AMC Network. Shudder is a premium streaming video service super serving fans of all degrees with the best selection of horror and thrillers. Shudder's irrepressible and thriving community revels in all things provocative, evocative, and dangerous. From bantering with Shudder on social media and contributing fantastic, irreverent reviews to relishing in member-only perks such as exclusive releases and VIP movie screenings, Shudder believes there is safety in numbers. Don't be left in the dark alone. You can now stream great thrillers, horror, and suspense for $4.99 a month or $49.99 a year. Shudder has the largest, fastest, growing, human-curated selection of thrilling and dangerous entertainment. To try Shudder for free for 30 days, go to shudder.com/podcast and use the promo code WAVES. That's Shudder, shudder.com/podcast and use the promo code WAVES.
You should go on Shudder right now just to watch Terrified. Use the code WAVES.
And I can confirm Terrified is Shockwaves approved.
Woo!
Because we did talk about this when I saw it at Fantasia.
Okay.
Tonight's episode is also sponsored by Fright Rags. Fright Rags is the number one source for horror t-shirts. With specially curated collections created by renowned horror artists, they offer the best art and the best quality anywhere. Recently released, Halloween may be over, but we've reprinted many of our popular Halloween releases, in stock and ready for the holidays. Also, keep Halloween haunts alive all year round with an official Haunters The Art of the Scare t-shirt. Brand new this week, our first Pet Cemetery collection, featuring four brand new shirts. More to come in 2019. And right now, you can get 10% off of any Fright Rags purchase with the code SHOCK10. Again, go to www.fright-rags.com, insert code SHOCK10, and get 10% off of any purchase. Good now through December 31st.
Today's episode of Shockwaves is sponsored by Diabolik DVD, featuring demented discs from all over the world. Check them out online at www.diabolikdvd.com. They are the number one source for horror, cult, and strange films from around the world. The company's movie buff owned and operated. If you're looking for rare, unique, and strange films, then you need to head on over to Diabolik DVD. They are constantly updating their inventory and have plenty of movies that you won't find anywhere else. They recently revamped their website, and ordering has never been easier. Right now on Diabolik, they have the all-exclusive Blu-ray of Death House, which has been called The Expendables of Horror, starring genre legends like Adrian Barbeau, Barbara Crampton, Bill Moseley, Debbie Rochon, Dee Wallace, Felicia Rose, Gunnar Hansen, Kane Hodder, Michael Berryman, Sid Haig, and Tony Todd, all in one movie, and it's a region-free Blu-ray. They also have the all-region Blu-ray of Cyborg, an alien fugitive crash lands on Earth and begins turning people into cyborgs that feed on animal flesh. Dylan and her best friend Eddie have to team up to stop the Cyborg before the whole town is assimilated into monstrous machines of destruction. Of course. So for all your horror and cult...
I have that problem every night.
Exactly. Of course you do. So for all your horror and cult cinema needs, head on over to www.diabolikdvd.com or find them on Facebook.
I just bought Candyman from them, the Arrow edition, and the Fog 4K.
And it's one of the only places you can find that extra disc in America, which is an all-region German. And I haven't done it yet, but I got to buy it.
Thankful for Diabolik DVD.
Christmas is coming. Diabolik DVD.
Yes.
Okay, and welcome back to the show. Very excited to have an old friend, a very old friend of mine. Very old, as in we've known each other way too long. We're both old now. But also because we've tried several times, I think, to get you on Killer BV and this. You do not live in Los Angeles, so that is the deterrent. But welcome officially to Shockwaves, Mr. Yeah. Paul Davis.
Thank you.
Paul Davis.
Yes. I'm excited to finally be able to do this.
Yeah. Yes.
The last time it was Culver City traffic that kept me away.
Yes.
And ironically, I came from Culver City today to join you guys.
But you left at 3 o'clock, which is why you made it on time.
I did.
Which is
it took you
difference.
4 hours to get here?
It took me 4 hours to get
That wouldn't actually surprise me.
There you go.
I didn't even know. I remember when I met you last time, I didn't even know that I'd shown that short film at Jump Cut. Oh, I knew about the film, but I didn't know you were the director of it until recently when I was like, I'm reading about the body going, that sounds familiar. I'm pretty sure there's a short like that. And you're like, that's Paul. And I was
that's the guy I met.
Oh, you have no idea how many times I've seen on Twitter that the feature of Hulu, the Into the Dark entry, is a ripoff of my own short.
People like posting oh, this guy ripped off his short film.
That's funny.
That's crazy. That's
how dare you rip yourself off? Yeah.
Well,
Paul.
There you go.
It's crazy. Yeah. Let's go backwards a little bit. But starting with The Body, which was kind of the kickoff film for Into the Dark, the Hulu series. Mm-hmm. The thing that I'm not just saying this because you hear it. This hit all my sweet spots because I love horror comedy and we have a very similar sensibility. So I had a blast with this thing. But what I was most impressed about is I saw the short. I liked the short. And all I could think of is I have no idea how you make that into a feature.
Me
at all. Well, but you did it.
Did you say that
in the first meeting?
I have no idea
how to make this into a feature.
Yeah, no, that's why there was a 5-year gap between the short and the feature because – honestly, that short kind of it had a life of its own. I really didn't know that it was going to take me in the direction that it did. And I'll be 100% honest with you. I was never really happy with the short because there was a lot of stuff. And there's a fun story that I'll tell you that kind of connects to while we were shooting the ending of the Into the Dark episode. But there was a lot of stuff that we couldn't shoot for the short that every time I watched it and when we were in the edit – I knew that that stuff was missing, and I had to do like a, as far as I was concerned, like an ADR hack job to make it work. So so when it kind of traveled and, you know, it premiered at Fantastic Fest here in the US, yeah. It won Best European Short at Sitges. Those were not things that I was thinking of when this thing kind of went out into the world. And it got me noticed, and, you know, it's why I'm in LA today, and I got the chance to do this film. CAA signed me, and I ended up being introduced to the town, and in every meeting I was asked, so you're going to make it into a feature? And I always said no. You know, I did what Ray does on the roof in Ghostbusters. You know? And I drove my management nuts because of that.
But to just cut in, you had other feature-length scripts.
We had other, yeah.
Other ideas. It's like, but no, I have all this.
Right,
why would I?
Right. Yeah, but everybody just wanted the body, and, you know, the irony of ironies. It took us about a year. Paul Fisher and myself, who was my co-writer, he produced the short. We talked about it for a year before we even had an idea of how we could expand this, because we honestly had no – it wasn't a proof of concept. You know, this wasn't something that
– Did managers or agents ever come back to you with ideas and say, Paul, if you can't come up with an idea, we'll certainly pair you with somebody who can? Or did you ever get pitched back ideas that were expansions of it?
No, I really didn't. Huh. Really didn't on this one. Yeah. Because I don't think anybody else could figure out how to do it. You know, and it was just one of those serendipitous things where I watched a double bill of After Hours and The Terminator.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I just thought, you know what? That could be interesting.
Yeah.
And then Paul Fisher came back to me and he was like, well, what if we made this really kind of esoteric screwball romantic comedy scenario between the hitman and this girl who's infatuated with him, and he doesn't understand why she's infatuated with him. So it kind of we like created like this It Happened One Night element between the two characters, and we were calling it His Girl Friday the 13th while we were making it, which was fun.
Actually, I really like that as a title.
Yeah, that's good.
It's good.
But yeah, I mean, the thing that's really kind of remarkable to me is like this time last year we'd only just started writing the script, and we wrote it on spec.
That's super quick turnaround.
This whole thing has been nuts. So we handed it in. Like I said, you know, I had all these other ideas and scripts, just throwing things at a wall for 5 years and seeing what sticks. Nothing did. So that's why we finally decided to take a crack at the body, and got a call within a week that Blumhouse and Hulu liked it and wanted to buy it. So it's like waiting for a bus in London. You wait 3 hours for one and five come along.
Yeah, yeah. So. And you have a cameo in the movie, but I'm learning from the ever-reliable IMDb that you are Nick Cage Dude, according
yes,
to the,
I just saw that.
I didn't know you had a name.
Well, I needed to be called something. I was dressed as H.I. McDonough from Raising Arizona.
Oh.
And Paul Fisher's in the scene with me. He's dressed as Mr. Hunter S.
Oh.
So, yeah, we're both in our obnoxious Hawaiian shirts taking shots to the Friday the 13th movies, which is a true story.
Yes.
That's why I put it in the film.
My favorite part of the movie.
Who else is in the party? Because obviously the Sasha Gray is the DJ.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah.
I noticed you guys. Who else? Who else is in there that people should be keeping an eye
on? So costume-wise and reference-wise, there's a guy dressed as – this is where I kind of went to town in the costume design and just thought, what? I had a guy dressed as Z-Man from Beyond the Valley of the Dolls.
In his
Superwoman getup. I had a guy dressed as Danny Elfman as the devil from Forbidden Zone. I had one of the dancers dressed as Kelly LeBrock in her phys ed costume at the end of Weird Science.
Yes.
There's tons of stuff in there. I just had fun with it. There's a big graffiti guest book on the wall, which you rarely see in there. It's only in a couple of shots. But it's got the Hellraiser 2, Help Me, I'm in Hell.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, wow.
You know, all that kind of stuff. Yeah, there was a lot of stuff I just made up on the day.
And John Landis was in there, right?
John Landis was in there.
Yeah, his cameo made me laugh, too. Yeah. Which is funny because the spot where his cameo is, you can't really see it in the final movie, but there was one night that I was watching After Hours for the first time, and you immediately texted me. And you did the same, put the same thing
the
on
same
the wall.
Graffiti,
the same graffiti,
with the penis.
But our one was a crocodile.
Okay.
but the same thing, but with a crocodile.
And Landis was playing Leonard Maltin in the cameo?
He was playing Leonard Maltin.
Just organically? It's like, I can't tell, yeah.
So here's the thing. The thing that I think is interesting, because, you know, now we're celebrating your first film debuting. But your path there, I think, is what's interesting. So the reason I met you is because 10 years ago, 11, 12, I can't remember exactly when.
It was 07.
I was doing the Psycho Legacy documentary. Mm-hmm. You were doing a documentary on American Werewolf in London, mm-hmm. which ended up being Beware the Moon, and it's on the Blu-ray. And I think, I can't remember if you reached out to me or whatever, but basically we were both fans making documentaries mm-hmm. about Universal movies. And
it was the MySpace days,
and
baby.
MySpace, and neither of us had the rights to do what we were doing. Yeah. So I think he reached out and was like, hey, has Universal come after you yet?
And it was the three of us together. It was you doing Psycho, me doing Werewolf, and the shark still working. All trying to get permission from Universal.
Yeah. That's pretty funny. And so that's where we ended up first just starting talking. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, we're on this path to make documentaries about movies we love, and none of us have permission to really do it. Mm-hmm. Can any of us get away with this? And thankfully, all three of us did.
Yeah.
Which is nice.
Yeah, we all ended up getting released.
But the thing is, I like movies, but I never really wanted to direct narrative stuff. For a half a second, I thought maybe, mm-hmm. but no, I like documentaries. That's my thing on the side. But for you, it's fascinating because you did this documentary, which got a lot of attention. Also, you could pull off being the host of your documentary because you got an amazing British voice, which is, I can't walk around and talk about Psycho, but you walking through the moors.
I hate it.
It just sounds smart.
It just seems logical.
I hate the documentary for that reason.
Let's go to the slaughtered lab. It's wonderful. But that's the thing. So you do this documentary. It gets a lot of attention. You get the support of the filmmaker, John Landis. Mm-hmm.
That's the only reason it came out.
Yeah. And that was because he called Universal and basically said...
No. It's kind of the reverse. I started cold calling cast and crew from the movie saying that I was doing this documentary. And I was like, it's going to be on Channel 4 in the UK. It's going to be on DVD. I was bullshitting them, basically. And I didn't get in touch with Landis until I had at least three or four key people from the UK involved. So Jenny Agata, John Woodvine, David Schofield, those kind of guys. And I reached out to Mick Garris and said, like, I'm doing this thing on Werewolf. Could you pass this letter on to John? And he did. And like 3 days later, I got a message from John in my inbox.
Oh, wow.
He was like, I'm flattered, but why?
That was a really good John Landis. That was like spot on.
Basically, Paul just channeled John Landis. Yeah. John Landis' soul came out of his mouth.
Yeah, that was really good.
He has sat on the throne, right?
He's changing it to John Landis
right now.
in front of our
eyes. Like generating glasses.
Rick Baker is behind the scenes just pulling levers.
Pretty good.
So did you get his support right away?
No, so he then said to me, well, his thing was like, why do you want to do this? You're crazy. And, how do you expect to do it? Because you don't have the rights.
Yeah.
And I came back to him with a very matter of fact, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it.
Yeah.
Which is what he was told every day by the crew on An American Werewolf in London. Yeah. It was like, how are we going to do this? It'll be all right on the day, Governor.
the British way, yeah.
And I think that endeared him. I think he just loved that I had the balls to do this in the first place. So he just said, look, if you get Universal to agree not to sue you before you finish it, then I'll take part. So I had to email Colleen Benn, who was the head of...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know that name.
Yes.
She was the head of bonus features for home video. And I knew that the Wolfman remake was coming up. So I said, look, I'm doing this documentary. Would you guys look at it, for a future release? It's the advent of Blu-ray, so it's coming at some point. And I just got like a one sentence, no, we're not interested.
Yeah.
And I wrote them back and I was like, but surely with The Wolfman coming out, every werewolf title you have is going to get a re-release. Like, nope, not interested. So I called up the licensing department at Universal and I said, how much would 18 minutes of footage from An American Werewolf cost me to license? And I got like a feedback. It was like $600,000+. It was ridiculous.
Oh, wow.
It
was
nuts.
Yeah, okay. This is all accurate.
It was nuts. And so I was like, okay, well, that's that out the window. And she was like, well, what are you doing? And I told her, I was like, I'm making a feature-length documentary, and I've got all the cast and crew together, and they're going to talk about the movie 25 years later. And she was like, and home video don't want this? Are they nuts? And I was like, well, you work with them. You tell me. And she said, give me 30 minutes. What's your email address? And I gave her my email address, just thinking that that was like the most polite brush-off I'd ever had. And then, lo and behold, 30 minutes later... her email popped up in my inbox and it just said, send it here when it's done. And it had the address. So I just pressed the forward button, put in John's email address, sent it. 10 minutes later, I'm in London next week. Great. Let's get together.
Yeah.
So, and that's really how it happened.
What was that person's name? What was that woman's name? Do you remember?
I wish I remember.
Champion of your
life? I think I still have it in my archives with a star next to it.
It is a good message, though, that it only takes one person to give a shit.
And that multiple knows it only takes one yes.
And they'll be a lot nicer if you have a British accent as opposed to me. Because I never got
those. Did you get lots of no's?
Yeah.
Did you not try? Okay.
No, I did. I did. It was no's all across the board. Yeah. And then the licensing thing was a nightmare.
If you want to make a documentary...
But haven't those rules changed?
No, well, I mean...
Yeah, well, now there's fair use, which I definitely would have tried.
No, but even fair use has certain restrictions to it. Like, with fair use, you have to do something that is completely transformative. So you can't just be like, here's awesome stuff from American Werewolf in London.
You would have to completely change it. That's a crock of shit now.
I'm telling you,
the stuff that people get away with on fair use. Had we had that 10 years ago... It would have been a whole different ballgame.
Well,
and I wish we did.
No one told us.
Nobody knew how to use it or properly. Wow.
Supposedly, and I've seen legal teams go after people and tell them that they have to change stuff around. But supposedly, you cannot include anything that's fair use unless you are doing a new take on it, something that has never been stated or presented before.
How the hell are you supposed to run by all that? How
exactly.
Are you supposed to look that up.
Yeah. But
what's the Eli show that you just you guys have been watching?
History of Horror.
History of Horror. Just go
you don't
on
think
Shudder.
Paying for it though.
Not at all.
Okay.
There's no way they are. I know I mean, I don't want to call them out, but every documentary on Shudder and none of those people post me and Paul since we were the guinea pigs that, had to go through the process.
Wow.
They don't pay for it at
all. I'm intrigued just because I see what we
If I didn't, I would have actually maybe made something.
At USC, I see what we have to go through to use stuff like that. So I'm intrigued.
Paul, I'm curious about your creature performing days, past and present.
I remember. You're a Wookiee.
Well, beyond that, I remember when.
There is no beyond that. No,
he's before, a Wookiee.
There's a beyond
I
that.
I think that's the
guys,
time. If it comes to creatures.
Werewolves versus gladiators.
Oh, wow.
What is that?
Let's
that's
go back.
Wow. Back.
Let's go back in the day.
Okay, right, I'm pulling
right. I'll pause on the Wookiee.
When
this.
I get a press release in the mail, in my email, to cover this on shocktillyoudrop.com.
Wow.
And I see. Press release for a film called Werewolves versus Gladiators. And the lead werewolf was going to be played by none other than our guest.
This
what
is
happened
not,
to that project?
Yeah, this oh, is not man. On your IMDb, sir.
Yeah, I don't think it's on anybody's IMDb anymore. So that was a project that came about through a conversation. I went to dinner with Neil Marshall.
Yeah.
And he had an effects artist with him called Sean Harrison.
Mm-hmm.
And this... crazy title comes into conversation, and I was like, what is this? I want to be a werewolf versus a gladiator or whatever. And because of my height and my build, Sean was kind of looking at me going, that wouldn't be a bad idea. And then I told him, this is around the time Beware the Moon was coming out. And literally right after the premiere of Beware the Moon at Fright Fest in 2009, I opened the door to the auditorium, and there standing there is Sean Harrison, the director of Gladiators versus Werewolves, and the producer in a line, and immediately just says, would you like to be a werewolf? And I was like, well, that was easy.
Yeah.
And from there, I went in and met with them. It was AV Pictures in the UK.
That's right, yeah.
Who did Dog Soldiers with Neil Marshall. Yes. And it was a director called Rob Green who directed a 2001 World War I ghost story called The Bunker.
Uh-huh.
Oh. I've seen that.
So it was going to be his follow-up film. And
pre-Overlord War
movie.
Wow.
Yeah. And immediately I was sent off to Pinewood Studios and was encased in alginate and plaster.
They went that far.
They had the money to start building this stuff.
Wow.
And it wasn't just me. It was so I played the youngest werewolf in this tribe of werewolves. And then the lead werewolf was Spencer Wilding, who went on to play he was the Wolfman more than Benicio del Toro was. Mm. He was Darth Vader in Rogue One. Mm. He's quite recognizable in Guardians of the Galaxy. He's the guy that plays around with Star-Lord's earphones. He's that guy. And then the elder werewolf was going to be Ian White, who's the giant from Game of Thrones. So they just had these three tall guys together, and And they have a lot more experience than I do. This was going to be like my first thing. So I hung out with Spencer a lot, and he was kind of teaching me how to move because he's like an MMA guy. And he was like, yeah, spend a week with me and, you know, we'll get you in shape, that kind of stuff. That never happened. I then ended up working with Ian. I didn't meet him in that process, but I ended up working with Ian on Solo, and that came up again in conversation. It was just a case of we were doing all of the creature effect stuff and getting all the molds taken right before the holidays. And then after the holidays, it didn't exist anymore.
Right. What was the gist of the story? I mean, like, Werewolves versus Gladiators obviously gives you a peek inside it, but I mean, like, were these werewolves connected, or were they constantly werewolves?
Set in Gladiator times?
It was.
I'm kind of hoping it was.
It was.
Okay, good.
It was.
And Becca, that's Werewolves versus American Gladiators.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's actually pretty good.
I wanted, like, Roman times. So, yeah.
It was essentially Gladiator meets dog soldiers, you know. It was a tribe of kind of feral human beings who, you know, at the full moon turn into werewolves, but they're captured by these soldiers that want to use them in gladiator battles.
So it was played seriously.
It was played totally serious, which I think was probably half the problem. But it was interesting, and being someone who was obsessed with creature effects and stuff like that, and just coming off of doing the werewolf doc, you know, of course I wanted to be caked in makeup and turned into a monster. I mean, the first thing that I ever saw when I was a kid was Thriller and the making of Thriller, and I watched that religiously to the point where I could watch any horror movie knowing that it was just makeup. So it ruined storytelling for me for a long time. But yeah, I remember the first time I met Rick Baker, he just looked me up and down and said, I want to put you in a monster suit. I was like, okay. But yeah, that's what happened with that. So money ran out and it just didn't happen.
Well, Becca and I are going to team up on Werewolves versus American Gladiators.
I think that's our next project, Ryan.
Becca, what if they think the American Gladiators actually get thrown back to Roman times?
Oh,
just
hot tub time machine mixed
only,
with.
Only if they can take the foam bats with them.
Oh, yes.
Somehow those transport with them.
And they think they could take on real gladiators with, like, maces and axes.
Amazing.
And
yes. Wow. Can we greenlight this right now, Ryan? Let's just get this
done. A Dave Dakota.
Yes. Talking dog in it. It'll be
you
on TV.
You have to do
the
A-Team style montage where they build the giant sphere that they run in.
Oh, we're definitely going to need a giant sphere, Rye. It's happening.
And then somebody puts a werewolf in the giant sphere, and someone goes, look at that giant gerbil.
There you go.
Oh, but the werewolf has claws and can claw its way out of the giant sphere.
This thing's writing itself.
What if it transforms while in the sphere, Rye? This is tight.
Pretty cool.
This
in one tight. Take.
Launch in one take.
Daylight.
Wow.
Nice.
Sorry, yes. Rob.
No. I mean, go for it. But yeah, I feel like every 7 years, one of your projects is going to come back to you, like the body did, or whatever.
Let's just set it during a purge so that we can keep it consistent.
Yeah, purge. So after, basically, what I wanted to get at is, so you directed this documentary, and then you did everything from other docs. Writing books based on
movies? I didn't do another doc. I was working on another doc that George Romero was producing.
Oh, wow.
Ironically called Into the Darkness. and it was Paul McAvoy, who runs Fright Fest in London, who was one of the producers. He was like the catalyst for that project. And they shot 90 interviews with everybody.
What was the focus of it?
It was what scares horror filmmakers.
How recently was that? Because I remember seeing that on IMDb.
I feel like I was interviewed for it too. Yeah, we were both interviewed for that. So what happened?
Well, what happened is I'd just done Beware the Moon. So Paul and Johanna, who was his other half at the time, they shot all this footage, but then didn't know what to do with it. You know, so they brought me in, and I literally sat in their house for a week just watching everything and essentially just trying to create a narrative out of it. And they got some absolute gold. I mean, everybody's – I mean, you guys are in it. Guillermo del Toro, Clive Barker, Landis, Joe Dante, George Romero, Dario Argento, Everybody is in it. But the problem was everybody is essentially asked the same question, giving the same answers. Mm. So I just couldn't figure a way to tell a story out of it.
It could be a really good web release thing, like little
– You know what?
Yeah.
It could.
Yeah,
all year.
And I believe Paul still has all that footage. If he doesn't, I know I do.
Sell it to Shudder and be little nuggets.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Little bite-sized nuggets.
So that one nearly happened.
I'm surprised they haven't like used that footage for Fright Fest promotion. Like, just like, oh, here's some cool exclusive stuff to show.
Right.
But anyway, we're giving you all gold ideas.
Yeah.
but the thing is, so you know, you went from – you directed docs. You wrote books like the Lost Boys book. You – played creatures and stuff, including, again, we were talking about Star Wars. So you did a lot of weird different types of things, but was directing narrative always the goal?
Or were
you just kind of going with the flow?
It was just a case of idle hands. You know, these were things that kept me busy while slowly waiting for the rejections of, of my scripts. Yeah, I'm just one of those people. I mean, I just got back from vacation, and it was 3 weeks of doing nothing, and it drove me nuts, you know. So I just have to stay busy. That's kind of my thing. And if I can't direct, then I'll act. If I can't act, I'll write a book on some other movie that I love. You know, it's I just need to be doing something.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, tell us
that's
about
that's why
the...
we're here on the podcast.
Yes.
We all have that problem.
That's
yeah, once
exactly.
a week we need to be doing,
something.
Yeah.
Well, tell us a little bit about the book stuff, because basically what you did was the book version of what Behind the Mask was, but specifically for The Lost Boys.
Mm-hmm.
And why was that a book as opposed to another documentary like that?
Well, the book thing started, first of all, I came across a company called Dead Mouse Productions who do – they did the Leviathan documentary on Hellraiser.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. They did You're So Cool, Brewster, the Fright Night documentary.
Yep, yep.
And I think they're doing RoboDoc. They're doing an It original – the original miniseries, a documentary on It. They're now doing one on Police Academy. Very versatile group.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I want to watch the Police Academy one.
And they started releasing their own books. And the first one they did, because I think they wrote the More Brains documentary for Return of the Living Dead as well. So what they did is because they had kind of like a time code Word doc for that documentary, they just Crystal Lake Memory style ported it into a book.
Yeah.
And I saw the design of it. And Gary Smart, who runs the company, he was designing all these things himself. And I saw the book and I was like, who did this? He was like, I did. You know, and we're self-publishing. And I was like, are you fans of American Werewolf? Because I had the same thing. I had a Word document of the time codes. And I thought, well, we can just do a Crystal Lake Memories for American Werewolf. And I still had all of the images that Landis stole from the Academy to put in the documentary on my hard drive. And so I had all this great material. And literally from when we had that conversation – that first conversation to me having the first proof in my hand was 3 months.
Wow.
It went super quick. But again, it's only because I had 60% of it already in a Word doc.
Yeah, I completely forgot that you did a book version of Beware of the Moon as well.
Yeah, that's the one that came first. And then that sold out pretty much straight away.
That's awesome.
To the point where they were getting abuse online from people who couldn't get it.
Hmm.
So they did like a soft cover reprint.
I don't know if that ever made it here to the US.
Everything went through their website,
You
know, because I think they only did 1,000 copies, something like that. And then because it sold out, they were like, we want you to do another one. You can pick the movie. And I was very, very, very close to doing Poltergeist.
Ooh.
To the point where I started making a list of everybody who I could reach out to see if they'd be interviewed, thinking in the back of my mind that neither Spielberg or Tobe Hooper were ever going to speak up because it's one of those controversial.
We're well aware.
What's the controversy? I haven't
heard. Oh yeah, have you not heard what Zelda Rubinstein said that time?
I'm outside that circle.
Yeah,
Elric didn't get screamed at over Twitter for that for weeks. Now
there we go. So I ended up going to a midnight screening of The Lost Boys at the Enzian Theater in Orlando, which Tim Anderson, who used to do the Bloody Disgusting pod, runs.
Yep.
And he invited me along, and it was sold out. And just as soon as that Warner Brothers logo came up, and you heard the little cry, little sister,
yeah,
the place just erupted, and it was like a rock concert. And I was like, this could be a fun book. And so I sat on that for about 3 days, and then it dawned on me that I had to then go through all of the, hey, you don't know me, but all over. It was like starting from scratch.
Yeah.
And the thing with The Lost Boys is, again, there's a lot of controversy behind that because of the two Coreys. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a lot of kind of trash talk. You know, there's a lot of tabloid junk that's kind of connected to that. So I just said to everybody that I emailed, look, you don't know me from Adam. I've just written this book on an American Werewolf in London. It's a celebration. I want to do the same for The Lost Boys because it was the 30th anniversary. And I just said, you know, at the gate, there's going to be no trash talk in this. You know, I'm not out to embarrass anybody or dig up old wounds from 30 years ago. I just want to celebrate this film that people love. And people really responded to that. And I didn't know who I would get. And then I think within 3 hours of each other in the same day, I secured Kiefer Sutherland, Joel Schumacher, and Corey Feldman, who I didn't think I would get.
Wow.
Wow.
You know. And even Joel said to me, he's like, well, you'll never get Jamie. Jamie won't do it. The ponytail just grew, by the way. And the same with Jason Patrick. He's like, you know, they don't talk about it. Uh-huh. But I managed to get a way into both of them. Jamie actually never did promo interviews for it. She was caught on set, and Fangoria got a couple of quotes out of her. But that was it. And her memory was pin sharp because she hasn't spoken about it, you know, in such a long time. So everything to her was fresh.
Was there any reason for, like, you know, I never know if, like, people just have a difficult time on certain movies and don't want to talk about it.
Well, no, I asked her about it, you know, because she was very fun and very upfront and very generous with her time, you know, considering it. I was told that she wouldn't do it. I was on the phone with her for about 2 hours just talking about it. And I asked her at the very end. And it was like, you know, Joel said that you wouldn't do this. And she was like, well, you know, I've always been a person that moves forward, you know, and it's not that I'm not proud of the work that I did, but I just feel no reason to revisit it, you know, and I respect that, you know. And Jason admitted to me up front, he said, look, it wasn't a movie that I enjoyed making. You know, he didn't want to do it in the first place. It took months of Joel badgering him to do it. And then Jason said, well, I don't have to wear the makeup, do I? And Joel was like, absolutely not. But in Joel's defense, it wasn't decided that Michael would turn into a vampire for that final showdown until halfway through the movie because they didn't have an ending. Right. You know, if you read any version of the script, that is not – every version is different for the ending.
But that's like what launched his career. You think that he would definitely give it a bit more love.
Well, there you go.
He's a very serious actor, though. That's probably what it was.
He did Frankenstein Unbound like 2 years later.
And you have to remember, Speed 2 is a very serious movie. it's set on the water. Which and is
do you,
serious.
Do you delve? I have a couple of Lost Boys questions because do you delve at all into the director controversy? I don't know if that's even been tremendous.
What was that?
Well, Richard Franklin was the original director, Psycho 2 director, and he was fired off.
Well, he wasn't the original director. Oh. So what happened is it was two writers, James Jeremiah, and I'm blanking on the second writer. They wrote it. Jan Fisher and James Jeremiah. So they wrote it as a spec, and it was essentially Peter Pan with vampires. You know, what if the legend of Peter Pan that you knew of was different? You know, the reason that he can fly around and that he's an immortal child is because he's a vampire. And it was written at a time where there was a lot of buzz coming off of The Goonies. Mm-hmm. The Goonies hadn't even come out yet, but there was a lot of studio buzz about it. So everybody wanted kind of Kids in Peril movies, you know, and they wrote it on spec, and it went out on like a Friday, and there was a bidding war, and PSO actually ended up buying it, who were a company that did Short Circuit, Flight of the Navigator, 9.5 weeks, eight million ways to die,
giant films of the time,
and these are all movies that everybody thought were going to be huge, including the two writers, which is why they turned down Warner Brothers and went with them. So
wasn't Short Circuit big though?
Short Circuit
did
money.
That's
probably the only one
that. Yeah, Short Circuit did.
And
money.
I feel like Flight of the Navigator was really big, at least for kids at the time, because I watched the shit out of that.
Yeah, the I think the majority of those films were those that found their audience on video.
I heard on a couple of days ago on a podcast, I heard Joe Dante talking about Inner Space, and he was like, everyone thinks that was popular. He's like, it was a total bomb, but home video.
All these things.
He said most of the movies of the 80s didn't do well theatrically.
It's the tweet that he put out yesterday.
Yeah.
It's like $4.99 right now on iTunes.
And
he
like,
quote tweeted it. So, yeah, that's how much it made on opening day.
Yeah, it was hilarious.
Which is heartbreaking.
It is.
On the same show, they had the best quote I've ever heard. Where it was Ron Perlman. He said, he got advice. He goes, if you want to become a millionaire making independent film, you better start out a billionaire.
There you go.
Like, that is such a good quote.
Yeah.
It's like so spot on. It was just like gold.
That is wonderful.
Yeah.
So no, but the irony is, so PSO bought it.
Yeah.
And they were like, yeah, we want Richard Donner to direct it. I'm like, great. He's got a deal at Warner Brothers. Yeah. So they had to go back to Warner Brothers, who they turned down.
Yeah.
And like, will you make our movie, please?
Wow.
But Warner Brothers ended up taking control of the entire thing. Because once Dick Donner was going to direct it, and he'd just come off the Goonies, and it was stalling and stalling and stalling, and then a little movie called Lethal Weapon comes along, and that takes his attention. Mm-hmm. So he brings in Richard Franklin, and I didn't get a lot of details. Mm. I didn't push for a lot of details.
Todd Franklin would have been pretty old, right, by that point?
No, he just directed Cloak and Dagger.
Yeah.
I
guess that's right.
He died pretty young.
Yeah.
Like, he was 60s. Really, when he died.
Yeah. Yeah, and Cloak and Dagger was the kind of vibe that they wanted for the film at the time. So I think Richard Franklin was only on it for a month. It wasn't very long. I reached out to Mary Lambert because I heard that she met on it. But she just said that she had very little to do with it. So I think it was, would you like to do this? No. Okay. Yeah. And then Mark Canton, who was the president of Warner Brothers at the time, took Joel Schumacher to lunch and said, look, this probably isn't your thing, but please do me the courtesy of reading this. And Joel knew immediately that he didn't want to do it because it's a little kid's vampire movie. He's just come off of St. Elmo's Fire. Yeah. But then he went running. Like, as soon as he finished reading it, he went running one morning, getting ready to then go and tell his agent and Warner Brothers that he was going to pass. Yeah. And as he was on his morning jog, he kept thinking about the imagery of the cave and all this cool stuff that he could do with it. And then he went into Warner Brothers with a music video of Duran Duran and said, I want it to look like this. And they were like, okay.
Wow. So,
whatever you want, Joel.
There you go.
Yeah, that was a fun period for him. I mean, in terms of that and Flatliners and stuff. You know, super creative.
Is your book still – is Lost Boys book available still?
They're all gone.
It's one of those American Werewolf things.
Got it.
That's sad.
What I'm curious, if you had your druthers, what would you want to tackle beyond American Werewolf? What would be the next big thing?
I think part of me would still really like to do Poltergeist.
Still? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, even delve into –
even with the challenges of not having Spielberg or Toby,
it would be difficult.
I feel like you'd be like challenging yourself, going, "Yeah, it's somewhat incomplete." And
Well, it's I know the guys who have just done the RoboCop doc have done so without RoboCop.
Oh, that Paul Rudd? Wow.
Yeah, I very nearly didn't get David Norton for the werewolf doc.
Wow.
Yeah.
And Griffin Dunn was like a last-minute addition, wasn't he?
Griffin was the last interview I did because that was the night we hung out in New York.
I remember that. Yeah.
And I went to interview him the next morning, severely hungover. Every time I see his interview in the dark, I just remember how shitty I was feeling.
But he was kind of just because – well, I don't know if it's because – but I remember you telling me like he was really upset by seeing himself dead in the movie a lot.
Yeah.
Like it really – Rick Baker's work was that good that it actually upset him to see it.
Yeah, and
which I think
he was just freaking out that his mom would see it and freak out. You know, this is what your son looks like dead.
Wow.
You know? And that was funny, actually. When Griffin saw the documentary, there was some kind of back and forth. I was out of the loop on this, but he got wind somehow that Rick Baker was upset with him because of the way Griffin is very matter of fact in the documentary, and because there's this famous story when they did the wolf attack on the moors, they did one take, and like after Rick saying, "Please be careful with this thing. It's foam rubber. It's very delicate. We're in the middle of nowhere. It's freezing cold. It's going to take a long time to fix this thing." First take, he ripped the foam face right off the mask. And in the documentary, Griffin's just like, "Yeah, it's called acting. I got so carried away." You know? And Griffin then got word that Rick was really upset that he said that. So I went to Rick, and he was like, "No, that's not true." So
how weird.
I don't know.
Wow. Last question about Lost Boy stuff. Does your book, or did you in your interviews, talk about any of the proposed sequels over the years? Because I know it took – I mean, there are sequels now. Mm-hmm. There's a 2 and a 3. But I remember that was like when we were buying scripts at Fangoria shows, and mm-hmm. like they were every like Tarantella type, but it would say The Lost Girls is coming. Yeah, like yeah. There's like 8 million variations of a sequel to that movie.
I remember
that just never happened.
Yeah, hearing forever before The Lost Boys 2 that is in existence came out. Like we would get that announcement at Fangoria mm-hmm. every couple of weeks that they were rebooting The Lost Boys. They're all coming back and it's going to be their kids now.
Yeah.
And we would
Eric
hear that
Red
all the
did
time.
A script.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And that, I think that's online.
Read. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think The Lost Girls was around until about 2005, and I think Amanda Seyfried was involved at one point.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's true, but the closest it ever got to having a sequel with the majority of the original cast back was in 1990, and it was Jeffrey Boehm who did the cleanup yep. on Jan and James's original script, who wrote it, and it was just insane. You know, there was a scene where one of the vampires at the Boardwalk Carnival like rips the Ferris wheel off its axis.
Wow! You know,
it's like, yeah, we made a little bit of money on this one. Let's up the budget a little bit. But apparently, it was just completely unfilmable. And I think Warner Brothers were just afraid to go near it.
Put
again
the money
after
into
that.
It. Yeah,
yeah,
that's crazy. I got to ask about Star Wars because I just watched it last night.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I mean,
it's a fun little movie. It's a Western in space.
Oh, well, I love it, but I mean,
Obi-Wan is so good.
I think all of us.
I know what he's doing. I see what he's doing.
But no, I'm saying
you're talking about Solo.
Yes, Solo. Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah. In case you didn't know, Paul is one of the Wookiees in Solo. And actually, I remember you swore me to secrecy.
Mm-hmm.
If I could say that now,
mm-hmm.
when you told me this, and I was like, "Holy shit!" Like we all grew up on Star Wars movies.
Mm-hmm.
If you told me like, "Hey, do you want to be like a fucking stormtrooper just in the background at the cantina?" I would have been like, "Yep." Yeah, I want to be in a you're in a fucking Star Wars
Jawa.
Movie.
I would have wanted to be a Jawa. Yeah. Just saying about those little Jawas.
GD. Just, you
know, so. As long as I get to do the noise.
Yeah, yeah. But so how did it even happen? I mean,
So I was working again. It was another failed project that just kind of opened up this new avenue. I was making an anthology in London, which was very close to happening. It was called It's Walls Were Blood. It was kind of a very throwback to Hammer and Amicus.
Mm-hmm.
And we had Michael Sheen, Toby Jones, Steve Oram from Sightseers, yeah. Pollyanna McIntosh.
Wow.
I want this to happen.
So do I. I wish it was still happening. It was one of those things where we had everybody locked to these ironclad contracts with these dates, and then the production designer decided that he was going to take a bigger paid job a week before he would start building sets at Pinewood. Everything just fell apart like a domino effect. And it broke the producer's heart. And, you know, he didn't feel that he could go back to it. But the guy who was doing my effects on it is a wonderful effects artist called Waldo Mason, who did the effects on – he was on The Wolfman and all that kind of stuff. He's a kind of a regular fixture in kind of the UK creature movies. And I asked him to do the effects for what would have been my segment in the anthology. And he told me that with regard to the dates that we had scheduled in, he was like, "I can only do up to this date because I'm going on to that little space movie that's starting up again at Pinewood." And I was like, "Oh, which one's that?" You know. So he went on to do Force Awakens, and he tried to get me on that. And it's my own fault that I didn't end up in The Force Awakens, and I kicked myself because he was actually putting me forward for an audition for Chewbacca.
Ah.
And he just said, "Look, just take a selfie, like a full-bodied selfie of yourself, like wearing cycle shorts and nothing else." So I took that picture and I sent it to him, and I got a call from the creature department secretary saying, "Hey, this is the creature department at Lucasfilm. Do you have like a resume or something? Because right now we just have a picture of you in your underwear. and I was like, yeah, that can be arranged. I was literally just about to go on vacation. So this was October 2013. And that was the year that The Body won the Best European Short at Sitges. So while I was away, that took all of my attention because now, you know, my agents are like, okay, well, we've got to get you to Hollywood and all this kind of stuff. I got home and completely forgot to send my resume to Lucasfilm. So fast forward a couple of years, I get a random text message while I'm DJing in a club in London from Waldo saying, quick, send me your resume. They need tall people again. And I already had my resume on my phone. So I just sent it like straight away. And then I got called and asked to come and do an audition, which essentially was a movement class. And I'd just done Doctor Who right before this. And it turned out that the guy who was doing the audition was like the legendary Doctor Who creature performer called Paul Casey. And as I walked in, so they were auditioning about 10 of us at a time. And it's the first time I've been in a room where I was the shortest person.
I was going to say, are there 10 people in the UK that are as tall
as
you?
they auditioned about 300 people from 6'8" to 7'2".
Wow. Oh my gosh. And had them do a movement class?
And have them do a movement class.
I really want to see
what
that.
What are you, like 6'6"?
I'm 6'8".
Oh, yes. 6'8".
Yeah, okay. It's on your IMDb.
Mm-hmm. His nickname is Tall Paul, and it's not just a clever.
There you go. So yeah, I went in and I kept getting called back. And I went in the day that I went in to have my body scan. They said to you, look, this doesn't mean that you have the part, but you know, we're scanning people so that we have backups, you know, which I didn't kind of figure how that worked at the time. But then when I saw one of the guys get sick during the shoot, and then one of the guys that was also scanned who didn't get the part came in, I was like, hey, I remember you, yeah. You know. I went in, I had my body scan, and that was a weird experience.
Yeah, what is a body scan?
Well, I'm used to, like, when we did Gladiators versus Werewolves, I was just encased in alginate, which looks like Smurf has just had a happy accident all over you, mm-hmm. and then cased in plaster, and, you know, you're completely deprived of your senses for at least 2 to 3 minutes while this stuff is, you know, doing its job. For this one, I just went and stood in front of a bunch of cameras and watched a 3D model of me appear on this screen. It was really bizarre.
Wow.
It was like The Matrix. It was just flashes going off all around. And then after that, I was then asked by the secretary, would you stay behind for a video test? And I was like, well, it's not going to hurt my chances, so sure. And I went into the creature shop, and on the bench in front of me was a very familiar brown furry suit. And Maria Cork, who's the head fabricator at Lucasfilm, said, okay, we're just going to put you in this and then we'll take you outside. And I just looked at it and I was like, put me in what? Put me in this? And it was Chewie's suit from The Last Jedi. And they were like, yeah. And they put me in this thing. And as soon as the head went on, I just burst into tears. And I was like, I need a mirror. I need to see a mirror because I know I was never going to get a picture of it.
Yeah.
You know? So I just went, they just took me to this huge mirror and I just stared at myself and it was just bizarre because I knew that I was looking at the mirror but Chewie was staring back at me. Mm-hmm. It was absolutely bizarre. And then they took me outside and just threw buckets of water over me and like John First Blood Rambo style with a power hose, you know. And Neil Scanlon, who's the head creature guy, he standing there with his power hose. He was like, do you remember the beginning of First Blood? I was like, yeah. And he just turned it on. and then they got the camera out and they were like, okay, so do what a dog does when it's drying itself. Right. And I was like, you want me to Taylor Swift it? So I just shook and shook and shook. And that was my initiation to the Star Wars universe.
Wow.
To be a wet Wookiee.
Wow. And I mean, I assume when you're on a project of that scale, like, are you allowed to tell anybody?
No.
Other than,
didn't even tell my family, really.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
They're just like, Paul, what are you doing tonight? Oh, well, I got to go.
I'm doing a period drama.
Well, so what's next? What are you working on?
May or may not be writing another episode of Into the Dark, which is possibly going to be happening. We're still working out the kinks on that one.
Yep.
And I'm attached to a screenplay called Go to Hell, which I was only saying it a few weeks ago. I read it, put it down, marveled, read it again. Like immediately started making my lookbook before I told my agent that I wanted to do it. And it's essentially Rosemary's Baby in the vein of Shaun of the Dead.
Oh, wow.
All right, sure.
A married couple figure out that their their marriage is cursed, so to speak. Okay. And anybody who tries to get in the way of the sanctity of their marriage die in very Final Destination ways. And so they have to kind of put their differences aside to trace the roots of the curse and see what happens.
Wow.
That sounds fun.
But it's a comedy. It's I've been pitching it as a romantic comedy.
All right. So. Sounds on brand to me.
Yeah.
Very cool. Well, thanks so much for coming in and talking to us.
Thank you.
If
you haven't seen it yet on Hulu, check out The Body.
It's a lot of fun.
The Dark. A lot of fun. We'll have you back on sooner rather than later.
Yeah.
We'd love to. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, Thank you. And happy Thanksgiving, everybody.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, we won't be here for Thanksgiving, but you will finally get to hear Elric's episode
from Knoxville.
With some fun people. We did our five horror films that made us kind of list.
Oh, great.
So there's a few of them. So it was a fun one.
Yeah.
All right. So that's next week.
Yeah. Cool. And watch Blood Rage.
Go Blood Rage.
Happy Thanksgiving. Watch Blood Rage.
Happy Thanksgiving, guys.